Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. Emiliano Gandolfi will be back with us in a couple of weeks, but he's currently ensconced on a remote Mediterranean island working on a top-secret project. We'll let him tell you about that when he gets back. Joining us this week is Professor Ronald Rael. Rael holds the Eva Lee Memorial Chair in Architecture and a joint appointment in the Department of Architecture and the Department of Art Practice at the University of California, Berkeley. He is an applied architectural researcher, design activist, author, and thought leader in the fields of additive manufacturing and earthen architecture. His creative practice, Rael Sanfratello, is the recipient of numerous awards, including being named the 2014 Emerging Voice by the Architectural League of New York. Last week, John Kerry left off with a broad condemnation of the proposed U.S.-Mexico border wall and other architectures of violence, and it left me thinking that there's more to this story. I think that designers, especially young designers, face tough choices these days about what they can and should be working on. And what's the proper response? What's the line between activism and design, if there is one? I asked Ronald to come on the show and talk to us about his latest book, Border Wall is Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. As you'll hear in the interview, the book is an extension of a decade of research by Rael examining the border, constructions on the border, as well as their architectural and social implications. Rhetoric over the U.S.-Mexico boundary, as well as other borders and border walls, has exploded in recent years as the Donald Trump administration has made a territorial issue into a hemispheric one, perhaps even a global one. Present in the discussion of this particular border are wider considerations of how we separate space between nations, between communities, and between people. And what role do designers play in that? Rael will offer his opinion on the evolving role of architects and specifically how designers can navigate this conundrum. Let's get into it. Ronald, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for lending us your time and lending your insights to our audience, especially during final review week. I know it's a busy time for us all, but we really appreciate your being here and coming to shed lights on border wall, your new book, issues of contention within the design field, and generally perhaps the topic of resistance. Yeah, so
thanks for having me.
Yes. You know, the topic of the border wall and the border has elevated quite dramatically in the last couple of years with a lot of the rhetoric that has surfaced in the U.S. presidential election. And we know that architecturally speaking, this is not a new issue, not in the United States or elsewhere. This is something that a lot of people have been studying for a long, long time. Yourself, I think about a decade, correct?
That's right.
Can you tell us, how did you originally get interested in these sorts of issues? I mean, what initially drew your attention there?
Well, I think that it came from maybe the place where I grew up initially, which was the northernmost frontier of Spain and later Mexico in southern Colorado. And this was the border between the United States and Mexico. And so I was very aware of the cultural differences that continue to exist in that previous borderlands. And I began to work as an architect in the Southwest, particularly in Marfa, right around the time before the Secure Fence Act of 2006 passed. And we were doing projects in Marfa, working on both sides of the border with craftsmen and adobe makers, and finally culminating in a project called Prada Marfa, which was really about these distinctions between wealth and poverty, the United States and Mexico, luxury and scarcity, in a landscape where we often encountered Border Patrol agents and Border Patrol agents picking up people who were walking in the desert. And I thought those kind of juxtapositions and ironies were fascinating. And also began to see that the heightened militarization of that border was prompting the construction of wall, especially after 2006. And so I began to take students to the border to just document and understand what was happening, because these were major construction sites. And at that time, I was seeing this as really a construction site for that looked a lot like architecture, but I wasn't sure if it was architecture or not. Mm. And what it meant to construct this wall in that landscape and to think about the spaces that were being affected by the construction of the wall.
If I'm reading your statement correctly, I mean, there was a physical construction going on, but also a social and political construction that was happening.
Right. Myself, you know, I was living in New York City during 9/11 and going back and forth to Colorado and to Texas during that time and experiencing maybe the problematics of being a young male individual at that time, who has dark, long, curly hair, flying airplanes. Just in many ways, seeing how the wall was symbolizing a kind of gesture towards national security and wondering if that was really a true consequence of or an effort towards national security or not. And so I became interested in that and I think became very aware of the stories that were emerging from that landscape, whether the wall was being proposed to be constructed through universities or wildlife landscapes or cities or deserts. And in each case, there were interesting conditions that were arising because of the construction of the wall. And so I just began to write down those stories and occasionally I filled up several sketches of thoughts about that landscape relative to the wall.
How is the dialogue different now than it was 10 years ago, or I guess when the Secure Fence Act passed?
You know, you started this conversation mentioning how this wall has been studied and walls is kind of a condition that exists around the world and it's well known. I think it's well known in particular circles, academia maybe being one of them. And what I found fascinating was that not a lot of people actually knew that a wall was in place. And so another reason why I sort of started to move towards this book. The dialogue has changed in a number of ways, and I think there's a rhetoric around the wall. And at that time, especially when we were working on Prada Marfa and after 9/11, the dialogue was largely around terrorism and national security. And we've seen how that dialogue has changed. Previously, it might have been more around drugs, and now it is a question of immigration. And it's being politicized in this current administration. I'm always surprised, and I mention frequently how when Donald Trump was campaigning for president, he would stand in front of crowds and say, "I'm going to build a wall." And everybody would clap and cheer as if someone had finally come to finally build this wall. And but the thing is that one third of the border is already walled off.
Mm-hmm.
690 miles of wall exist. And so for the conversation to still also remain as if a wall doesn't exist, to me, is also a surprising phenomenon. So I think it's important to bring this issue to light.
Ronald, in your book, one of the themes that I drew out was the idea of, the rhetoric on the wall. The ultimate purpose of it is not to actually construct a physical wall, but rather to create social and political walls, to create a sort of rhetoric around race and class and politics. Is this one of those examples where, you know, the social manifestation of a physical implement of architecture eventually becomes bigger than the architecture itself? I mean, as you said, there's already a wall there, I mean, for at least a third of the border. So how are we even able to have this conversation?
That's a good question. I mean, right now, just about a month ago, the first prototypes for Donald Trump's wall were presented to the public. Each of them cost about, you know, close to $500,000 a piece, ranging from $300,000 to $500,000 a piece. They're prototypes that are about 30 feet by 30 feet. So they're not very long as a wall goes. They're certainly imposing and of an imposing architectural scale at 30 feet. But that's 30 feet at a cost of $500,000.
And imagine how much does a 31-foot ladder cost?
Right, exactly. Exactly. And to present these walls as a kind of, let's say, security innovation is pretty incredible when you think that here are these two walls that are saying, look, here are the walls that we're going to build, but they're actually sandwiched between a double wall barrier along the border that already exists. So you don't see that in the photographs. You just see these superimposing walls, but you don't see the context in which they are in, which is a highly militarized, walled world.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're perverse in some ways, and almost perverse in the same way that in my book I attempt to demonstrate that perversion by putting small pieces of the wall in these snow globes. And so in a way, these samples look a lot like those snow globe samples, as if they are just these remnants or artifacts of a world that is somehow, that its reality is stranger than its fiction.
For our listeners, we'll feature those on our website, but Ronald is not exaggerating. This refers to a set of architectural interventions called souvenirs or recuerdos, where Ronald has actually proposed alternative wall scenarios encapsulated in snow globes as an architectural artifact.
Yeah, I actually don't like to think of them as alternative wall scenarios, as I think about them as memories of a time when a wall existed that are encapsulated in this, form. So there's a misunderstanding that my book is actually a series of proposals for the wall, and it comes out at a coincidental time when the president of this country is proposing walls. So there's the misunderstanding is that, oh, here are some walls for Donald Trump. But in fact, it's really the book is a biography of the wall that tells a story of the phenomena of the wall. So these small models and drawings that are in the book are attempts to reconcile with the spaces of consequence that the current wall that's in place is affecting. While they are presented in the form of models, it suggests that they're a proposition. In some ways, we might think about them as propositions because in many cases, I'm arguing for their dismantling, or I'm advocating for some other kind of investment in design along the border. Rather than a wall, let's build libraries. Let's invest in solar energy. Let's invest in wastewater treatment facilities, because the border is a rich landscape, a cultural landscape, an urban landscape, where it's one of the fastest growing landscapes in regions in both countries, in the United States and in Mexico. And it also has some of the poorest counties in the United States. And so I feel that if we are going to invest in that context, in that place, why not invest in education, in culture, in energy, instead of what I think is a symbol of security and a symbol that many perceive to be a symbol of xenophobia and racism. And so this is what I'm advocating for in the book, and this is what the book discusses.
We'll feature it on our website as well, but you've given several lectures where you actually make direct economic comparisons between the wall and other propositions for investment, right? So give our listeners a sense of scale for what we're planning to spend on this wall. How many public libraries could we build?
It's estimated that the current wall that's in place to finish its construction and to maintain it over the next 25 years is going to cost $45 billion. And so if you ask yourself, what else can $45 billion buy in terms of architecture or design, you could buy several hundred Seattle public libraries, for example, or 500 miles of the High Line in New York City. And so if you imagine that kind of cultural investment on the border, what kind of transformation would take place? And you know, I often have conversations with economists, for example, people who are thinking about alternative strategies for immigration reform, and they all agree, okay, if we improve economies, if we improve education, if we invest in a kind of social capital, that would make places on both sides of the border better.
Right.
And so why don't we make that sort of investment? And so these are questions that I don't have answers to, but I'm interested in understanding more about.
I think one of the debates that's surfaced within architecture, and I think all the other design professions as well, is one that's touched on in your book. And I don't want to give a spoiler alert or kind of give it away, but perhaps we could talk through it a little bit. Mm-hmm. You touch on the debate, let's say, between a proposition of non-involvement of an architect or the profession of architecture saying, hey, we're just not going to touch this because this is immoral, this is an architecture of hate and xenophobia, versus taking an approach like the one that you've described in your book, where we're offering an alternative vision, an alternative proposition. Mm-hmm. For those architects out there, especially the younger ones in our audience who are struggling with that, should I or shouldn't I, which course would I take, what sort of advice would you give to them in terms of navigating their own futures in this current political climate?
Sure. Well, I've been talking about the book as having the same kind of ethos that's attributed to an architect named Hassan Fathi, who wrote the book Architecture for the Poor.
Sure.
He is known to have said that architects do not build walls, they construct the spaces between them. And so I like to think about this book in this way, that the ideas behind it are not about constructing walls, but to think about the spaces that are between them currently and what we might do in reaction to the wall. Some have proposed to me that you cannot engage in this conversation because as a designer, that makes you complicit in the violence that the wall perpetuates.
Right.
And I understand that reaction. And I wrote an essay about Michael Sorkin's call to ask architects not to be involved in design of prisons. And I drew similarities between thinking about the involvement in the design of prisons and the involvement of the design of walls. I agree that they are in the same, we might see them in the same light, that I don't agree that architects should participate in the design of walls, fundamentally because I don't think there should be a wall in place. It's not that I'm against security, but I think that it comes at a cost of taxpayer money and a cost of human lives. But I do think that we should consider a rethinking of that wall. And I think there are a number of ways to engage it. Ignoring it is not one of the ways to engage it. The wall is an infrastructure, much like many infrastructures that are problematic and that do propagate violence and divide neighborhoods. And we can think about highways the same way. We can think about bad social housing in the same way. So would we argue for architects not to consider those contexts because of the violence those contexts perpetuate? I don't think that we would. And so I think that we have to engage these landscapes and smuggle design into them and address the problems that the wall is creating. And if any architect is to call for the dismantling of the wall, then an architect is very irresponsible if they are not thinking about how to stitch those landscapes together after the wall comes down.
You know, it's deliciously subversive, you know, this idea that right-wing xenophobic politician can propose a particular form of architecture, and through our commitment to social justice, to good landscapes, to community, we can kind of insert a new future into that.
Right. And I think that it's happening in the other direction as well. This is pure conjecture at the moment. But there's an amazing artist in San Francisco whose name is Ana Teresa Fernandez. Mm-hmm. And she has this project, an art project that is part performance art, part activism, and part painting, because her weapon is a paintbrush, and she goes out and attempts to erase the wall using blue paint that matches the sky. Hmm. And from a distance, it has this amazing effect that it looks like she has erased the border wall. It's quite visually incredible. But if you look at the wall proposals that were proposed recently in response to Donald Trump's call for proposals, one of them has been painted a blue that matches the sky. And I can't help but think that they knew of Ana Teresa Fernandez's work and co-opted that strategy or that tactic as a vehicle in response to make Donald Trump's wall more beautiful, more invisible. Hmm. I can't help think that. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's interesting to speculate about that and to think how I have a quote from Thoreau in the book called Every Wall is a Door, and to think about how the walls that exist are doorways to discover how we might overcome them, and how these walls, these new walls, despite co-opting a particular tactic that worked against them, will be strategized against in the future. It opens up new doors for possibility.
You're listening to Social Design Insights. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Ronald Rael about border architecture and the spaces between walls, but we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking about the reception of the book and what issues that illuminates and how we talk about architecture and border politics. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We've been speaking with Ronald Rael about the U.S.-Mexico boundary and the role of architects in border politics. Let's rejoin the conversation.
Is it ambitious to think that, and maybe this is what you were just saying, that this wall itself could be the instigator of a new wave of design, a new wave of thinking?
I think that's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah. That when I say every wall is a door, these walls are new doorways to thinking about how we might react to them.
Well, that's encouraging.
In fact, I have a friend, I would say a virtual friend. We know each other via Facebook, a photographer based in Tijuana. And she has been documenting these walls. So I think she stands on top of her car to get just a view over the walls with a telephoto lens. And she's taken some amazing early documentation photographs and video of the walls. And I saw these come into my Facebook feed. And I couldn't help but collage in a series of ladders on them to tell her. I wonder if these $500,000 walls pass the, as you said, the $200 ladder test.
Right.
But just a week later, her and a group of activists got together and they projected images onto those walls, like giant drive-in theater walls, of different kind of messages about immigration and the U.S. being a welcoming country. But one of the images was of a ladder that they projected on the wall. And that was really beautiful to see. Because the ladder is becoming a symbol of a resistance in many ways. And a number of artists are using it to demonstrate, I would say, to render the wall as something that can be overcome easily, right? That there, again, it comes at a tremendous expense and cost of human lives. And if we ask why we are doing this, why are we spending so much energy in something that is likely to be ineffective? What good does it do?
You know, that was another interesting part of your book, because you spent some time treating, you know, all the means by which the existing wall has been defeated, you know, whether it's catapults or cannons or ladders or I was surprised to find out that people actually drive over the wall. They build ramps and, you know, just take a Jeep and drive straight over the 12-foot wall.
Right. 16-feet walls. I mean, there are trucks that have, what do they call, tracks that just unfold over the wall so that the vehicles can drive over them. So if there's millions of dollars in research funds that are going into thinking about the design of walls and being tested by ramming 40-ton vehicles at 50 miles an hour into these walls to prove their impermeability, the research that's going on in Mexico to surmount the walls is much more effective and much more efficient, and it comes at quite a lower cost.
Yeah. Excellent. Let's talk a little bit about the reception, I guess both the critical reception and the popular reception. Last time that you and I were together, you were telling me about a particular visitor to one of your lectures who was incensed at the idea that, you know, people could flow back and forth across the border. What has been the reception, both from critical circles and popular circles?
I always think about the reception in terms of what architects say and what others say. Let's say I sometimes divide it in that way. And the reception has been good when they hear me talk about it. Mm. In terms of a book being judged by its cover, I think it creates confusion in this political climate. I've been interviewed several times by news media live. Like, I was interviewed by CBS or ABC, I don't remember what, it was a live radio broadcast, and the guy comes on and he says, "Hi, we're here with Berkeley Professor Ronald Rail, and he has some innovative new proposals for Donald Trump's wall." What do you have to say? Like, wait, hold on, let's rewind a little bit, because this is an issue that's much more complex than that, and you kind of have to unpack it. And honestly, this book is my unpacking of it for myself, because it is complex and there are many constituents on both sides and many landscapes. And so when I have the opportunity to unpack it, or when somebody has read through it, it's very much appreciated. When it's taken as the cover, like border, like just reading the word border wall, okay, what is this? It raises hairs, or lines are drawn in the sand just because of the title. And so I think the reception has been good when there's an opportunity for conversation. And that's what the book was intended to do, to open a conversation.
Just for my curiosity, have you gotten any calls from the administration asking you for your input on the wall?
I have not. Okay. But the book was born through a conversation with the administration, in fact. So there was a competition back in 2010 sponsored by CityLab at UCLA to rethink infrastructure in the U.S. It's called WPA 2.0.
That's right. Okay.
And so some of the work in the book was in that competition, for which we were one of the winners. And so we presented this work in Washington, D.C. in front of lawmakers. And that was an interesting conversation that, like many architecture conversations, are slow. And I mean, what I discovered was that there are walls that exist within our legislature and its various factions that wouldn't allow for some of these ideas to take place. So would the Department of Energy ever work with the Department of Homeland Security in such a way that they're collaborating to bring security infrastructure or to bring energy infrastructure somehow together? I was told that likely those two departments wouldn't collaborate, because they're each trying to allocate money for their own agencies and don't want to share that money. So each are going to do their own thing.
Right. So getting back to your previous point about how the book was received, there's a beautiful quote towards the end of your book that says, rather than being viewed as meaningless monuments to an outdated method of dealing with immigration, the remnants of a reconsidered wall might be treated with reverence, reminders of a time of trauma that was overcome through creativity, resilience, and imagination. And at least for me, when I read through it, that was really about what the book was about. To hear you tell the story, we can think of these different ideas from the perspective of 50 years from now, looking back on a time when we thought about borders in a very, very crude way and then developed, you know, these ideas of creativity, resilience, and imagination to turn them into sites of production and community and harmony and growth and all the things that we actually want.
In some ways, I'll talk about Ana Teresa's project again. I love that project because of there's an embedded irony in that project of her erasing the wall through paint on one side. And that is because the community in Tijuana love that project and they protect it. And so there are a lot of graffiti artists who paint the wall, but they don't allow anyone to paint where Ana Teresa has painted.
Really?
They protect it.
That's amazing.
So if you imagine a president comes along someday and says, we must tear down this wall, people might argue for keeping that stretch of wall, which is an invisible wall.
Yeah.
And so the kind of poetics that are embedded in that are really powerful. When I think about the design that I'm considering for these places, there's often times that it demands an erasure. But in some cases, it demands to be built upon. It suggests that pieces might remain in place because there's an enormous material investment that's put in place. And can we not rethink this through a remodeling? And I don't use that term lightly. Architects might think of that term in a particular way, but I'm interested in the efficiencies. There's a term I often use. I don't think I mentioned it in the book, but it's a Chicano word called rascuache. And what it means is you do the best with the least you have, sort of like making lemons from lemonade. So that's maybe another strategy that I take on. Okay, there's a lemon that has been given. Can we make lemonade? I mean, that's the way I look at it, honestly. Like, what can we do? I mean, I think that is part of the struggle, and we have to face that struggle.
Personally, I can see a future, looking back 50 years from now, at some of these remnants, you know, these pieces of public art that serve to remind us of that time when, you know, we thought about nation states in a militaristic and xenophobic way, and a group of artists, designers, and architects proposed something different. And I don't know, it's a beautiful future for me to imagine.
You can find that occurring in sites where the Berlin Wall existed. There are cultural sites. There are places that were fortified, ignored, that are now parks and walking paths. And so that scar has to be dealt with, I think, in the future. I think I write about Lebius Wood's description of the scar in architecture and really embrace that as a way to think about the particular scar that's going to remain. And we can't just be cosmetic about it and cover it up and pretend it never happened. But how can we, in some ways, recognize the scar that exists? I mean, in people, I'm always interested in their own scars because the scars tell a story, and they help you remember those stories. They're often traumatic, but important in shaping a person's life. And so, I think that this is a particular kind of scar, and we have to reconcile with it. I was asked recently by someone in an audience saying they were concerned that I was normalizing the wall. And it was interesting for me to think about it in using that term to normalize the wall. And I'm still wrestling with that question, I think. But I'm not sure this is a normalization rather than it is a recognition that a wall exists. Again, I don't think that it's healthy in any way to ignore it or cover it up. I think we have to expose it.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank our guest of the week, Ronald Royal, for his thoughts on borders and how resilience and innovation can constitute the ultimate act of resistance. Next week, we're going to shift just slightly and talk to a few nationally recognized experts about the architecture of incarceration as we continue to consider the interplay between design and resistance. We hope that you'll tune in for that. You can find links to Royal's work at our website at socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Design Prize and the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter for all the latest news on social impact design. We'll be right back.